So 22 years ago, I was asked to supply preach at my brother's church, who was taking the Sunday after Christmas off, and he had asked me to fill in. Now, I was in seminary, and I had not done a lot of preaching up to that point. I had maybe preached two times in my entire life, 22 years ago, meaning that this was going to be the second time. Seriously. I was a first-year student, and even at this point, I hadn't even taken a preaching class yet. And since this was the profession I believed that God was calling to me, I figured when my brother, who was already a pastor, asked me to preach at his church, I should say yes. And so I did. But back then, preaching made me extremely nervous because I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, not only was I trying to avoid heresy at all costs, but I was also trying to stop myself from passing out or worse in the pulpit while trying to preach in front of a group of people. I mean, this was like these two double weights on me. So mistakenly, I said to my brother to give him a Sunday off, I said yes, and then I looked up the reading, and it was the one we just heard. And I thought to myself, how is a guy who has one semester of seminary under his belt preach on this very text? I mean, it's a two-sentence sermon. Killing babies is bad. Don't do that. Amen. Like, we can go home. I mean, I can totally see why any pastor would take the Sunday after Christmas off to avoid this reading. I mean, they weren't resting. They were hiding. And that's what I should have done instead of saying yes. And so I learned the very valuable lesson before I was a called pastor. When someone would ask me to supply preach, I'd always look at the readings before I'd say yes or no. However, I did write a sermon. And I'm happy to report that I do not have a copy of that sermon, nor do I have any recollection of what I said, which gives me hope that no one else remembers anything I said on that morning, okay? But here's what I do remember. It was two services. First one went well. I knew I was nervous. I knew I didn't like the sermon. And then there was this time in between like we have on a regular Sunday where there's time for coffee and relaxing. And I got to visit with the folks in my brother's church. And then as second service was about to begin, the second wave of people coming for service arrived. And the bishop of that synod showed up. Really? Of all Sundays, why would he come to my brother's church? I mean, I remember very little after that moment. I'll be honest with you. I kind of blacked out. All I remember the next thing, I was sitting in the car driving home like that. I'm pretty sure I got through it, and he didn't have me written up on heresy charges, so I think I must have did okay. But I can tell you with absolute honesty, that was the last time that I preached on this gospel reading. So today, not seeing a bishop in the room, is my shot at personal redemption on this very message. And so this was my brother's church, and before they moved into that church, it was actually a storefront because they hadn't built the building yet. So I was in a storefront, and that's what it looked at. But when we hear this story, what we call the story of the holy innocents, all you can say is it's bad, really bad. And it causes us to ask all sorts of questions like, why? Why would God let this happen? Why would this thing even be allowed? It's questions that even can't even be answered, honestly. They can't be answered in this life, and there's very little satisfying about the story, and there's nothing satisfying about the outcome of this story. But I want to dig in a little bit so that maybe we can find something here that we can help make sense of our lives today, because we can't change the past, but we can apply it to our future. Does that make sense? We can't change what happens, a terrible story, but maybe we can use something in the story to help apply to our future. So this is totally connected to the story and the visit of the wise men, or we also call them magi, as Mark read earlier. And when they arrive, they make their presence known to King Herod the Great, who is an awful person. And so if we're going to make sense of this story, what we need to do is learn a little bit about Herod so that we can understand and make kind of put this story into some context. It doesn't change the pain and the outcome, but I think it also fills in the blanks here. First of all, King Herod was not Jewish. He practiced Judaism, but he wasn't. He was actually from a place called Edom, which is kind of the home of Esau, of Jacob and Esau, of the Old Testament, but also think Arabic. It was close by Israel, but not in Israel. He was a Roman citizen, and through his political contacts, he was actually a close personal friend of a Roman general named Mark Antony. And so as Mark Antony climbed the ranks of power, Herod came along with him. And just for a clarification, it's not that guy. That's Mark Antony. He's a singer. That's not him. Okay? Matter of fact, Mark Antony, the general, was a close personal confidant of Julius Caesar, and he tried to prevent Julius Caesar from being murdered, and he was delayed, so he could not do that. Later on in Mark Antony's life, he instigated a civil war for power, but failed due in part to his love affair with the Egyptian queen Cleopatra. Think, you know, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor here. So long story short, Herod was his kind of best buddy. And he was well connected in the Roman Senate and with the Caesars of that time. And Herod was appointed what we call a client king of Israel. He was a Roman governor is what he was. He was not a rightful heir. He was no king to the Jewish people. He would have been the same thing as Pontius Pilate at the time of Jesus' death, except he had the title of king. Now, to ingratiate himself, he married a Jewish princess from a ruling family called the Hasmoneans. So he wanted to have a princess wife, and he was a king. And this, he married into a family, this is really fascinating, was the same family that had led a rebellion in Israel 160 years before the time of Herod with the leader Judah Maccabee to get rid of a world power that had invaded Israel. And it was a group called the Seleucids. So when Judah Maccabee led this revolt, out of that victory came the miracle of Hanukkah, because they cleansed the temple and they had enough oil in their lamps to light the menorah for one day, and it lasted for 8 days. So he was marrying into that family and replacing that Jewish family royal dynasty. He was hoping that people would accept him by marrying part of this royal Jewish family, but it was clear he was pretending. He worked for Rome. He was not a Jewish king, and he was brutal, and he ruled with an iron fist. He was an ambitious builder, and I could go into a list of the things he built, including upgrading the temple in Jerusalem that nobody wanted him to touch. But he imposed his will because he was expected to keep the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, and he would do that through violence. So when he heard that the wise men had come because of a star, and they said that this star prophesied a Jewish king that was born in Bethlehem, and that they wanted to find this baby king to go worship, he knew that this was trouble for him and the Pax Romana. He said, this is going to interfere with the peace. Because remember, it was only 160 years earlier that the Jewish people rose up and beat a world power, and many people were still remembering this Maccabean revolt that caused the miracle of Hanukkah. Not only that, but they didn't like Romans any more than they liked the previous world power. So the fact that a king was going to be born was trouble for Herod. See, back then, the Jewish people viewed everyone who wasn't Jewish as outsiders, unclean, unworthy of anything, including God's love. And I think Herod fell into that. The Roman occupation of Israel, for me, would be like one of my 80, favorite 80s movies growing up in high school was when the Soviet Union, Soviet Union invaded the United States and kind of took up occupation in the western half of the United States, and the movie centered around a group of high school kids in the movie called Red Dawn. Some of you might know Red Dawn. Some of you like, yeah, Wolverines, right? Yeah, that's right, Wolverines. So it'd be like that. And it was like, we couldn't imagine having the Soviets here. And even the high school kids would rebel and fight off this attack. Same with the Roman occupation of Israel. So when there is a future king, life becomes very real to Herod. The baby is a political threat. So he instructs the wise men to come back after they found the baby so that he can worship the baby too. Well, they have a dream, and they're told to leave town. Don't go back and see Herod, and that's exactly what they do. Now, Matthew's gospel is filled with dreams and visions. Remember, it began with Joseph having a vision of an angel telling him to stay with Mary. Then the wise men receive a vision saying, please do not go back to Herod, and they do that. And then another vision of angel comes to Joseph and says, get up and take the baby and Mary and get out of town because things are going to get ugly. Go to Egypt. So why do they go? Well, one, an angel told them. Secondly, it is for their personal safety. But behind that, there are political reasons. Baby Jesus, the wise men say, this is a future king. They tell King Herod, this is a future king. The current king, client king, says, don't need any competition to keep the peace of Rome. And so there are political reasons to get rid of baby Jesus. And so essentially he becomes a refugee, even if he doesn't know it. And the legal definition of a refugee is this: an individual seeking refuge or asylum, especially an individual who has left his or her native country and is unwilling or unable to return to it because of persecution or fear of persecution, as because of race, religion, membership of a particular social group, or a political opinion. So there's your evidence. There are political reasons that Jesus, as a baby, would have no clue over, but that's why he has to leave. And so, that's what happens. The angel comes and visits Joseph in another dream, and they leave, and unfortunately, it's not the end of the story. I mean, you'd hope that they leave, and Herod finds out that they're not there, the end. But he gets angry, and it's well known that he has uncontrollable anger, and that he is duped by the wise men, and instead of killing one child for political expediency, he now has to take out an entire town of children, two and younger. So it's a horrible story. So where do we go from here? Well, like I said, I want to learn from that so as to act differently in 2017, and then maybe work towards the fact of being vocal enough that we can call attention to when things like this happen today in our world. Back in 1938, the Diocese of Southern Ohio of the Episcopal Church created a poster to remind people not to forget about the political refugees of Europe as we were heading towards war. And this is what the poster looked like in 1938. You're going to look at this and you're going to think, it looks like something somebody made today. But this is from 1938. In the name of these refugees and all refugees, through interest, through friendship, and through gifts. The Episcopal Church was trying to encourage people to help those who are political and religious refugees of Germany and those occupied lands to find a safe place that they could live and not be hurt. Matter of fact, in that same time period, believe it or not, in 1938, representatives from 32 nations gathered in France for what is called the Evian Conference to discuss growing concern of the thousands of Jewish, German, and Austrians that seem to be homeless and facing persecution. With the exception of one nation, the Dominican Republic, nobody did anything. Even the United States was unwilling to ease immigration restrictions. Instead, classic government, they established a commission to study the problem. You know what happens when we go study a problem? Nothing happens. So when I think about this story, I don't think we need to study the problem. We didn't need to do it in 1938, and we certainly don't need to study the problem now, and I'm not even going to show pictures of refugee children on the screen. But if you wish to go see some, type in Aleppo. Go to Google, type in Aleppo is in Aleppo, Syria. And for political reasons, they are being killed like children of Bethlehem, right? By their own government. Now, it's wrong. And it is sinful when nothing is done to help them. Now, it doesn't make a difference to me, and just to some people, it doesn't make a difference to me what religion these children are. I mean, it was a stretch in 1938 for Christians to help Jewish folks. See, when I think about who I want to be in this gospel story, I want to be the angel. I want to be the angel telling families not only to flee the danger, but also to give a destination, as if to say, come here and find safety. And in the same way, I don't want to be one of Herod's advisors or part of Herod's court, knowing that this is a really bad thing to do, but I'm not going to speak up out of job security or political expediency. We already know what happens in history when people don't speak up. Bad things happen. Now, it's fascinating that the law of Moses, the Old Testament law, refers often to the stranger, the alien, and the foreigner. In many places, I mean, if you have an electronic Bible, do a word search on those three words, and you will find a ton of places where God reminds the people of Israel time and time again that they were once foreigners in Egypt, back when they were slaves, when Moses was there. And essentially, the summation of several places in the law says, don't forget that you were foreigners once in Egypt, and you didn't like the way they treated you, so don't do it to other people. Treat the outsider like they are a local. I think almost all of us can trace our lineage to somewhere outside of the United States. Once we were strangers, or our family were strangers in a strange land too. And so I just kind of think that slamming the door on children who are in danger may be legal, but it's certainly not Christian. So, this is what I hope to live up to in 2017 as we begin a new year together. From the book of Leviticus 19:34. The alien living among you must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens once in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So I guess my New Year's resolution, if I was going to have one, is to love my neighbor no matter how different they are than they are from me. No matter how different they are, I'm going to love my neighbor, especially the most vulnerable, the children of this world. Because we can't change the past, but it certainly can help us think about how do we live into the future. And I think taking care of the children of this world is something we all should have our hearts and minds focused on. Amen.